Well, hello, everybody. This is a study on the 1845 Constitution of the United States of Texas.
State of Texas.
State of Texas. Excuse me. The state of Texas. The Constitution is now printed. Has been very carefully compared with its
conforming literally
to the original deposited in the Department of State. The punctuation also of the original has been strictly followed. The words are lettered, including in the brackets, are found upon the original roll in pencil and may have been intended as corrections, but by whom made those does not appear. We have the people of the Republic of Texas acknowledging the gratitude of the grace of beneficence of God in permitting us to make choice of our form of government, due in accordance with the provisions of the joint resolutions for annexing Texas to the United States, provided approved March 1st, 1845, ordained and established this Constitution. And we're now in Article 1, Bill of Rights. Would somebody like to take off with that?
Yeah, I could. Are you ready?
Okay. Yeah, we're ready.
Hey, well, let's go through the preamble first. You read it. Let's go through it. Talk about it.
Okay.
Rick, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off there.
No, it's okay.
My computer died on me again. I'm having problems. But go ahead and have we got any discussions on that?
Well, first of all, I'd like to note that this is in no way as magnificent as the preamble to the Constitution for the United States of America. And are the previous preambles more wordy than this?
The first question, and the second question is, I don't know.
The 1833.
Okay, well, it says in here, in accordance with the provisions of the joint resolution for annexing Texas to the United States. Whatever provisions and whatever joint resolution that was must have been passed under the 1836 Constitution, and that would probably be a better preliminary to this preamble. Do you think? I mean, what was that joint resolution? Does anybody know?
I have here the 1833 Constitution of the Republic of Texas, which is a constitution of the Republic of Texas. The first Anglo-American constitution to govern Texas. So that was drafted convention 59 delegates who assembled in Washington, I mean at Washington on the Brazos on March the 1st of 1836. The Constitution was adopted by the convention 15 days later and ratified by a vote of people of the Republic on the first Monday of September of 1836. And so from there, it jumps to the 1845, which is basically the same. There's really not a preamble. They really didn't have a preamble. And I may be telling you wrong, but I'm looking at this in front of me. And
okay, well, maybe this is something we could bring up next week, but we probably ought to read through that joint resolution for annexing Texas to the United States, because that's why this Constitution was written, right? In order to align it with the United States of America. Okay, I can put that as a to-do for next week.
Okay.
So we can go ahead and go to Article 1, I guess.
Ready to read?
Go for it.
All right. Article 1, Bill of Rights. That the general, great, and essential principles of liberty and free government may be recognized and established, we declare that, Section 1, all political power is inherent in the people, and all free governments are founded on their authority and instituted for their benefit, and they have at all times the unalienable right to alter, reform, or abolish their form of government in such manner as they may think expedient. Sounds good. Section 2, all free men, when they form a social compact, have equal rights, and no man or set of men is entitled to exclusive separate public emoluments or privileges, but in consideration of public services. Section 3, no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust in this state. Section 4, all men have a natural and indefeasible right to worship God according to the dictates of their own consciences. No man shall be compelled to attend, erect, or support any place of worship or to maintain any ministry against his consent. No human authority ought, in any case whatever, to control or interfere with the rights or conscience in matters of religion, and no preference shall ever be given by law to any religious societies or mode of worship. But it shall be the duty of the legislature to pass laws, to pass such laws as may, in parentheses, may shall be necessary to protect every religious denomination and the peaceable enjoyment of their own mode of public worship. Section 5. Every citizen shall be at liberty to speak, write, or publish his opinions on any subject, being responsible for the abuse of that privilege, and no law will ever be passed curtailing the liberty of speech or of the press. That's not going on lately.
Can we stop there and discuss whatever we've read, and if there's any questions?
Yeah, because everybody's being curtailed in their speech, their freedom of liberty and speech already, with the occupying stuff.
Well, there was one word I took note of, and that was all free men. And what does that word mean? What is a free man?
That sounded like us when we were born, but then we lost that.
Well, I think under the old English idea that free men were a class of people, but it did not necessarily include everybody. That's why we don't call ourselves free men. We call ourselves living souls. That word means something. I don't know what it meant in 1845, but nowadays it doesn't mean a sovereign individual.
Okay, according to Black's Law, a free man is a person who possesses and enjoys all the civil, and political rights belonging to the people under a free government. A person who is not a slave. A member of a municipal corporation, in parentheses, a city or borough, parentheses close, who possesses full civic rights, especially the right to vote. A freeholder. An allodial landholder. It's also written as a free man. Did that answer the question?
Well, not exactly. Under the English, a free man was somebody who the king gave land to, and he was allowed all rights and privileges to that land as long as the king allowed him to do so. So that was a free man. Now, what happened when we moved over into the Americas and we had the revolution? Did we change that definition? Because I saw you, when you read that, you said a freeholder. A freeholder is one who holds land freely from the king. So did it mean the same thing here in Texas?
Well, let's see if it has freeholder in here. Freehold. An estate and land held in free simple, in free tail, or for term of life. Any real property interest that is or may become possessory. At common law, these estates were all created by an Ethiopment with livery and season. The tenure by which such an estate is held.
Were those Latin words? I didn't understand them.
I have no idea. I've never seen the words before. Let me look them up. Okay, it's pronounced enactment. At common law, the act or process of transferring possession of ownership and ownership of an estate in land. The property or estate so transferred. The instrument or deed by which one obtains such property or estate. That's what the enactment meant. What was the other word? Season?
Yeah, something like that.
A season indeed is actual possession of a freehold estate in land by oneself or by one's tenant or agent as distinguished from legal possession. So which season was this? Okay.
This is from the Texas history book. I'm sorry, Linda, did you want to say something? Gina?
I was going to read the other Sesson's definition.
Okay, go ahead.
Completion of the ceremony of feudal investiture by which the tenant was admitted as freehold. possession of a freehold estate and land ownership. Louisiana law, the right that the law accords universal successors to own and possess a person's estate directly and immediately upon the person's death. So, did that answer the question?
Well, I just want to read something from a Texas history book here, and this is with regard to slaves. And this is the comment. It says, they left the land and thousands of plantation acres fell into disrepair and disuse. Somewhere a joyful but tragic rumor started that every freedman, was to get 40 acres and a mule. Bureau officers tried to dispel this notion, but for many months with limited success. So, there are other references in this Texas history book, but I can't find the word freeman. But I know over time we've been kind of warned by knowledge that the word freeman doesn't mean what we think it means. And I'm wondering if in Texas they knew what free man meant back in those days. You remember, Jeannie, you read that part about the municipal corporation, the right to vote.
Right.
We have that in the de facto right to vote, and that makes us a not free man, you know, or not a sovereign man. Because
but in 1845, the men had the right to vote, and they were still free men. The women didn't have the right, but the men did. So it was those that had the right to vote.
Okay, well, I think that's a word that needs to be defined. Would anybody be willing to go back in Texas history and find out what they meant when they used the word free man? Because like Gina just said, it's not all-inclusive, evidently. Right, Gina?
That's right.
Normally when we say free men, we include men and women because the masculine includes masculine and feminine when used in that manner. In English, anyway. Does anybody volunteer to do that?
I will.
No, Katie volunteered.
Under just the dictionary of free man, it says it's a person who's not a serf or a slave. Plain and simple.
Okay, so Katie's going to bring us a definition of free men from what the Texans thought it meant back in 1845. Is that okay with everybody?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I yield on that one then.
Any other questions about any of the other?
Linda, I have a million questions. I'm just hoping that somebody else does.
You're just like us. We're just reading it and learning it and trying to decipher it. So I have a lot, too. I question every day something, you know.
Well, I had planned on having these words looked up in advance, and I just flat ran out of time.
Well, that's all of our job, Gina. We can do that as we come across them. We'll, you know.
What about explaining what the indefeasible right, a natural and indefeasible right.
Where is that at?
Section 4.
Section 4.
Oh, okay.
That's almost like an unalienable right, I would think.
Or unquestionable.
Yeah. Undefeatable. Yeah. But the trick is how do we get our public servants to uphold this Constitution that we're reading from?
Hold their feet to the fire.
Yeah. How do we do that? Unless we all start carrying guns.
Well, hey, we don't even know what it means. How can we tell them what it means? That's why we're meeting.
They could make up something. They wouldn't know the difference.
Yeah, they didn't know the law they're purporting to uphold.
An indefeasible means not liable to being annulled or voided or undone. Now, what's Black Law say about Black Law?
That's what I'm scrolling back to.
I like that, not being that, not old. All men have a natural and unnullable right. So they can't take that away from us, supposedly, but they've managed in our schools.
Yeah.
Not vulnerable to being defeated, revoked, or lost.
Okay. Good word to hang on to.
Wow. So reread that sentence. All men have a natural and undefeasible right to worship God. What rights are we losing? And the Constitution says they can.
We missed what you said, Gina.
He may have dropped off too. I was far going, couldn't hardly ever get back on.
Oh, Brian got kicked up.
Yeah, I'm back on.
Okay. That section 4 is a really powerful one, the whole thing. I think we ought to read that again. Brian, you'll read it again? Do we lose him again?
Back again, sorry.
Section 4.
Gina, we missed most of what you said. Did you?
We are really on it.
Yeah, the Skype's going bonkers. It just dropped me again.
Yeah, it dropped twice.
Read that section 4. Somebody.
All right. Section 4. All men have a natural and indefeasible right to worship God according to the dictates of their own consciences. No man shall be compelled to attend, erect, or support any place of worship or to maintain any ministry against his consent. No human authority ought in any case whatever, to control or interfere with the rights of conscience in matters of religion. And no preference shall ever be given by law to any religious societies or mode of worship. But it shall be the duty of the legislature to pass such laws as may be necessary to protect every religious denomination in the peaceable enjoyment of their own mode of public worship.
Wow. says it pretty clearly.
About as plain as you can get.
I think we are all over Texas.
Linda, we're getting a lot of feedback from you.
From me? I don't know if it's me. I think it's from Doug. There we are. That took care of it.
That sounds better. I keep getting bumped off. I was...
No.
I was talking right along and turned around and my screen was black and I went, dadgummit.
Gina, you were going to read that by replacing the word indefeasible with what you just learned, right?
Yeah.
We missed all that.
You missed the whole thing?
Man got kicked off and then he stopped when he came back on. There wasn't somebody. Two callers.
In fact, they were attacking us through Skype.
Gina, you there? There's Gina again.
Yeah, I got bumped again.
Me too.
Okay. The word indefeasible, or did I lost it again?
Section 4. All men have a natural and indefeasible right.
Not vulnerable to being defeated, revoked, or lost. So with that definition, and we read the sentence, all men have a natural and vulnerable to be, not vulnerable to be defeated, right to worship God. And we cannot be revoked to worship God, nor can we lose our right to worship God. That's what that word means. We cannot be defeated, we cannot be revoked, and we cannot lose that right.
I think it's a good word.
I think that needs to be our motto, Section 4.
We are undefeasible. Or we are indefeasible. That's it, not an in. We are indefeasible.
In our right to worship. Okay.
Yeah. Tell that to the Muslims.
Section 5, every citizen shall be a liberty.
And those Muslim supporters over there in Ohio and Indiana.
Yeah. Hey, did y'all read Section 5?
Yes, Brian finished off. I was just rereading it a little bit.
Any questions on 5?
Well, hey, let's read it again. I don't remember him reading that. Did he read that?
Yeah, I read it. It's good, though.
Will you reread it?
Yeah.
You know, we might be better off just taking one section at a time and dealing with it and hitting us with a bunch because it's jumping around quite a bit.
Yeah.
I would take one section at a time.
Okay. It might be
a little bit longer, but I think we'll get more understanding. Anybody want to read Section 5 again?
I'll read it. Section 5. Every citizen shall be at liberty to speak, write, or publish his opinions on any subject, being responsible for the abuse of that privilege, and no law shall ever be passed curtailing the liberty of speech or of the press.
Okay, does everybody know the executive law that Obama put in last year?
The NDAA thing?
I don't remember the title or the number.
So that's if they hear you talking bad.
Right.
Or if you're speaking, they can throw you.
You cannot protest against him any place that he's at.
In his presence at all.
Well, it doesn't have to be in his presence. They can be, you know, the outside protesters.
Yeah.
They can all spend 1 year in prison for protesting him being in their town.
Oh, we need to storm that place and get him arrested.
Well, we just all need to get him out of office. That'll take care of a lot.
That's it.
With all the vote fraud and everything else that's going to be thrown, it's going to take an act of God.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my God is sufficient.
Amen.
Any questions? Five?
All right. Well, Linda, you wanted to go on to Section 5, but we have a question on Section 2 or something I think we should talk about.
Okay.
The social compact. Is that the Jural Society in Section 2?
Let me look it up and I'll see.
I think it is, isn't it?
I would think so. I would interpret it like that.
It's the promise to stand beside each other. It's a social compact.
It helps when you spell the word.
Yeah, this is a restatement of some principle that they already knew. It's...
Okay, I do not have a social compact in my dictionary. I have a social contract, but not a compact. Would that be the same?
It's pretty similar, yeah.
The express or implied agreement between citizens and their government by which individuals agree to surrender certain freedoms in exchange for mutual protection. An agreement forming the foundation of a political society. The term is primarily associated with political philosophers such as Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, and especially Jean-Jacques Rousseau, though it can be traced back to Greek sophists. So do we still think it means the same thing?
I don't think it means that.
All three men, when they form a social compact, have equal rights, and no man or set of men is entitled to exclusive, separate, public, immoral, or privileges, but in consideration of public services.
The word compact, having the property of being packable or compacting easily, closely and firmly united and packed together, having component parts closely crowded together, heavy and compact in form and stature, briefly giving the gist of something.
Well, we have the state compact. I mean, that's what we're talking about, isn't it?
That's what I'm thinking it is. I need to highlight that and make that a question for the governor. Okay. I'm going to hit him with all these questions.
Well, because it says, I, the undersigned, hereby affirm that having placed my witnessed autograph on the attached Declaration of Sovereign Rights held by Indigenous Power, and Declaration of Intent to Assemble and Adhere to the Standards of a Jurist, and Declaration of Domicile and Political Status. I mean, this is the fourth in that group, isn't it? The, I don't know, the first to take the state compact.
Well, when we form a social compact, we have equal rights, and no man or set of men is entitled to exclusive, separate public emoluments or privileges, but in consideration of public services. So what that tells me is all free men have the free their free rights. But when they form a social compact, they have that security of being in a social network for support. Like join the Jural Society, you fall under the protection of the courts and all as being in the Jural Society. But if you're not under the Jural Society, you can still vote and do things, but you don't have that protection of being, you know, having, I guess it'd be like having a lawyer on hand or a supporter on hand.
I take your point well, Linda. A little rewording might be that in the context of a social compact, those people that have made the compact, none of them is better than the other.
Exactly.
Somebody outside of that compact might be whatever, but within the compact, none of them is better than the other.
That's the way I would interpret that one.
Okay, and remember that under this Hague document and the governor's talking about Jural societies and things like that, and he says he finds this all the way through the Texas documentation, the constitutions, et cetera. That question should be, is that the Jural society that you're talking about, that social compact, when you ask him a question? Is that?
Okay.
And I'd like to note also here, but in consideration of public services. Now, what that means to me is if we hire and delegate authority to a governor to govern the state, and we pay him a consideration or an emolument, and we give him a certain privilege in order to carry out his office, that in those situations, they would be different than everybody else in the social compact because they have specific responsibilities and assignments that are delegated. But we don't give up any of our freedoms. We just delegate some to them. I think it's clear they are still our servants. They're not acting like it right now, but
well, hopefully
that's because they're not our servants anymore. They're the servants of the Queen.
Amen.
Okay, do we want to move on to Section 6, or do we have any more questions? Somebody want to read Section 6? Am I the only one here?
Linda, this is Katie. Section 6.
Oh, excuse me, everybody. This is Brian. I got to leave now. I got to go to work. So I wish you all a blessed evening, and I'll talk to you again probably on Thursday.
Okay,
good night, everybody.
Bye.
Okay, good night, Brian.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank
you, everybody. Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, Section 6. In prosecutions for the publication of papers investigating the official conduct of officers or men in a public capacity, or where the matter published is proper for public information, the truth thereof may be given in evidence, and in all indictments for libels, the jury shall have a right to determine the law and the facts under the direction of the court as in other cases.
Everybody know what this one means?
There was a lot there. I have to reread it.
And for the publication of papers investigating the official conduct of officer or men in a public capacity or when the matter published proper or public information that there are be in evidence. A good one.
Yeah, I like what it says. The jury shall have a right to determine the law and the facts, which is something like that they don't tell you when you go to.
Hold it, Katie. We've got somebody needs to mute out. We've got a bad echo.
Okay.
No, we still got an echo.
I'm gonna mute. It's me.
Like somebody just came in. If you're just came in, mute yourself, please.
Which is star six.
There we go. It's gone. Okay, Katie.
Oh, yeah, I was just saying in that section that I just read where it says, in all indictments for libels, the jury shall have a right to determine the law and the facts, which is something that I've heard many times that when you go sit on a, jury trial, they don't tell you that you can judge the law. This says determine the law, but I would assume but judge the law and the facts.
No, they don't say that anymore.
No, I know. Uh-huh.
And that's under the direction of the court, as in other cases. To me, this takes me back up to Section 2, which is that social compact or the jural society. Investigating that anything, if they're a public official and they're investigating this conduct of whomever is in a public capacity, that evidence is to be open, is the way I interpret that. It is to be public information. Are y'all?
I don't think that's what it says in English. It says in all indictments for libels. Libel is when you say something bad about somebody, but it's not true. Right? You have a libel. Okay. So that's in the context, and it says, and in all indictments for libels, the jury shall have a right to determine the law and the facts. So this is very specific as regarding freedom of speech.
Wow.
You can say something, just like in Section 5, but you're responsible for the abuse of that privilege.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know how that ties into official conduct of officers. What if the governor, the de facto governor, might do something like this? Say, oh, so-and-so is a dirty, rotten, whatever. And it's a lie. It's not true. He, in his official capacity, has committed libel. So is that what this is talking about? And why would it be in the Bill of Rights?
I think it's just meaning that if you abuse that privilege, and especially if you are an official, it is.
Or men in a public capacity.
When the matter published is proper for public information, the truth therefore may be given in evidence.
I think this one bears further study.
Yeah, it depends on what was their situation at the time with possessing to write it in there.
Okay, we'll put that one on hold. Do we want to step down to Section 7? You might be putting all these on hold.
I'll read it.
Okay.
Section 7. The people shall be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and possessions from all unreasonable seizures or searches, and no warrant to search any place or to seize any person or thing shall issue without describing them as near as may be, nor without probable cause supported by oath or affirmation.
In other words, you can't just barge into my home and search.
Right. Yeah, I think that's pretty clear.
Mm-hmm. Anybody got any questions on 7?
No, it's pretty clear to me.
8, someone? Section 8, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall a speedy public trial by an impartial jury, not be compelled to give evidence against himself, shall have the right being heard by himself, he shall have the right of being heard by himself, or counsel, or both, shall be confined with the witness against him, shall have process for obtaining witnesses favor, and no person shall be holden for any criminal charge, indictment, or information except in cases arising in the land or naval or offenses against the law or regulations. So that's land and sea.
Could you read that again, Linda? Something's really staticky, chopped. A lot of feedback.
Okay.
All right, I was reading it.
Pardon me?
I was reading it. I turned around and I lost connection again.
Okay, why don't you read it? Maybe you can, maybe it'll a little different.
Okay, Section 8. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall have a speedy public trial by an impartial jury. He shall not be compelled to give evidence against himself. He shall have right of being heard by himself or counsel or both. Shall be confronted with the witnesses against him and shall have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor. And no person shall be holden to answer for any criminal charge but on indictment or information except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or offenses against the laws regulating the militia.
I have a little bit of a problem with the to answer for any criminal charge but on indictment, I understand that, or information. An indictment would come from a grand jury, I suppose.
Right. But
where does information come from?
That's going to be your...
Well, upon indictment, then they have the second part of the trial, which is sentencing. So basically, upon indictment, then if he wishes to speak up, he must.
Usually before indictment, they have an investigating, they assign an investigating committee, a jury foreman will, or they will vote in an investigating committee to investigate to see if there is a need for indictment. And if not, then they're not held for any criminal charge. But if there is a need for indictment, then they pursue on with it.
Well, that makes sense.
Okay, an indictment is a formal accusation accusing somebody of a crime. Katie looked that up. What is
charging?
Or, if you use the word or, that means either one of these can be used to bring a case against somebody, either an indictment or information. And what's information?
I'm assuming that the information is going to be from the grand jury investigation. The indictment is going to be a result of that, or if the prosecutors have the information ready, you know, that would be permissible.
I'm looking the word information up, see if it's in my Black's Law. And it is. Find out what information means on the legal side. A formal criminal charge made by a prosecutor without a grand jury indictment. The information is used to prosecute misdemeanors in most states, and about half the states allow its use in felony prosecutions as well.
I don't like that at all.
No. Word says you got to have two witnesses at least.
It's also termed bill of information. So it's still a criminal charge made by a prosecutor.
The purpose of an indictment is to inform an accused individual of the charge against him or her so that that person will be able to prepare a defense.
Okay, but the indictment's presented by the grand jury, a grand jury. Information is presented by, what did you call it, Gina? District attorney or something?
Prosecutor.
Mm-hmm. So any prosecutor. Yeah, sorry. Linda, are you trying to say that the prosecutor doesn't take action until he gets the indictment in his hand, or?
Well, it's my understanding, okay, reading here, an indictment is found and presented by a grand jury legally convened and sworn. It originates when a prosecutor and is issued by the grand jury against an individual who is charged with a crime. Before such individual may be convicted, the charge must be proved at trial.
But the information didn't require a trial by jury, right?
But all before they can even go to trial, it has to go before a
grand jury.
Grand jury.
And the grand jury presents it to the court.
Well, that's true up until you get to or information. Or information, when you use or, it means either one of them will do the job.
Right.
An indictment from a grand jury or a prosecution from a prosecuting attorney, or whatever you called it. Gina, I'm sorry, I forgot
prosecutor.
Again. Prosecutor.
Prosecutor.
Okay, so I could be indicted by a grand jury for something and informed that there are charges against me for a crime by a grand jury. I could also be informed by the prosecutor that he thinks I'm guilty of a crime.
right? The prosecutor brings it before the judge, and the judge either accepts it or dismisses it.
He brings the accusation.
Right, the accusation before the judge.
Okay, now, how do you know he brought it before a judge? Where did you get that?
Not a judge or jury.
Well, no. My dad was a peace officer, a true one. And just being in the courts and stuff with him and listening to them talk, the prosecutor could go before the judge and say, I have this evidence. And this judge can say, bring it to court or there's not enough evidence, and throws it out.
And just to be clear, you're saying there was no grand jury involved?
No, there was no grand jury involved.
Well, he was later, but no, I wasn't.
I'm not sure I like this part of the Constitution.
Well, if you have that, still you have to bring your witnesses in to prove that the prosecutor's lying. And there's his job. His job's on the line then.
But, Gina, you see what's been... This is exactly what they've been doing to us for 100 years. They've been accusing us, getting us all mixed up in these legal systems that we don't know anything about, and by not going through the proper process.
Don't all you right. Think? The difference is with the Constitution, we still have, if we prove that this prosecutor lied, he can lose everything because now he's lied to the court, which is a felony. So is the prosecutor going to take a chance of going to prison? You better make sure before he goes to the court of what he's saying. Nowadays, they just, oh, well, I messed up, and go on to the next one.
It's not so, oh, well.
There's still a balance.
Yeah.
And if we elect a prosecutor, we want to find somebody that's honest.
But see, it's still blowing my mind, the fact that you're saying that it can go straight toward a judge without going before a grand jury. That's what's blowing my mind.
That's what it says here in the English, you know.
Yeah.
Well, we've already done that. We've already had a trial by jury, and we didn't go grand jury on it. When we went to Austin, we had a trial by jury convened. And that was when Chaplain Raymond requested one. And the judge showed up, and then... General Hightower brought his evidence in and presented it to the jury.
Okay, that was a trial by documentation.
Okay.
That was not a trial by jury. That was a trial by document, which he was wanting this documentation to be proven so that it... Was this documentation already gone to The Hague, or did he want it presented to The Hague? Does anybody remember?
Are you talking about General Hightower?
Yes.
He was there in defense of, it has already been to The Hague. All okay. The documents have been signed and sealed, signed and sent, and he's just proving, you know, that if we need to amend the document or something, it's
okay.
There. Yeah. So, in other words, he was trying to show what where Texas was in The Hague.
Right.
Well, we had a grand jury session.
Yes.
But we never did go to the trial by jury on it.
Well, it's my understanding that there are certain requirements to continue listed at The Hague to keep your information up to date. You have to have someone that has a legitimate address and information that The Hague can have on file. And obviously that was the case with Texas, that the last few years there has not been up-to-date information available for them. And so that's where we're at now.
The Section 8, it says in all criminal prosecutions, so that's the context here. And it may not be, well, it's not in all situations. It's in criminal.
Criminal.
Yeah.
And I know that in a criminal charge, it has to go before a grand jury, unless the defendant pleads guilty immediately.
Okay, and where are you pulling that from, Linda? Are you've got some experience on that, or?
Some experience on that. Not with us, but with family. It has to go before a grand jury, unless the information has already been, I mean, he's agreed that, yes, he's guilty, yes, this, that. But it's still, even with witnesses, they still have to go before a grand jury. And I may have to stand corrected on that, but that's my understanding on a criminal charge.
Okay. What we're comparing to, though, is today's and what a criminal prosecution was back in 1845.
Right. So look up that word criminal charge. What it's calling a criminal charge. That's why a lot of these cases, if there's not enough evidence to go before a grand jury, I mean, a grand jury can sit and listen to this evidence, but if there's not enough to indict him on that particular charge, it has to either been dismissed or it has to be sent out for more information. It can't just be hearsay. I'm going to ask Alton if I'm right on that.
Well, I think we could really stump the Attorney General on that one. What do you think? Anybody still there?
Yeah, I was looking up a criminal charge, and it sent me back to charge. A formal accusation of an offense as a preliminary step to prosecution. A murder charge, also termed criminal charge. An instrument or command, a mother's charge or to her son. So, preliminary step to prosecution of as an example, a murder charge is also considered a criminal charge.
You said a murder charge is what?
As an example, is what they gave. For a criminal charge, the example was a murder charge. It's the preliminary step to prosecution. A charge is a formal accusation of an offense as a preliminary step to prosecution. And it's also known as a criminal charge.
Linda, do you agree with me that that indictment is one thing and information is another thing altogether?
Linda, are you still here?
I'm sorry, my phone died.
Oh, okay.
I had to go get a phone.
I understand that.
Kind of like computer problems.
Do you agree that the I'm looking for my sentence. Matt, go ahead and rephrase your question again.
Linda, do you agree with us or me that the indictment is a totally separate item from information?
I do.
Okay, so by either method, a person could be charged with a crime.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I agree with you. But another thing is, where is that information coming from? That's another question there.
Well, if it's a criminal charge, it's a major offense. You know, the example was a murder. So if somebody witnessed a murder and went to the prosecutor and say, I saw it happen, he would bring it before the judge, I have a witness to this man committing murder. This is my evidence that I have. The judge can decide we have enough evidence and bring in the jury. So it's not a trial by judge, it's a trial by jury. The judge has decided there's enough evidence for this jury to hear it. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does, but it's totally surprising. I didn't know that would go on or be allowed.
I didn't either. I'm trying to figure that one out.
I just don't trust prosecutors, period.
But see, originally the prosecutor was to defend and protect the people. That was their job. They didn't work for the court, they worked for the people. So, you know, going back to if somebody came before the prosecutor and say, I witnessed this murder, the prosecutor takes down all the information from the witness and then brings it to the judge, that's where the prosecutor is working for the people.
He's going to have to be investigating first.
Right.
And that's where I'm thinking the information is coming from. The information is going to be from an investigation.
Okay, but that's a different form of information. That's a different definition. The information he is receiving is what he has learned about the crime. His evidence is the information.
Let's talk about the indictment. In the case of an indictment, a grand jury all on its own can go do an investigation if it wants to.
Yes.
Or a prosecutor can come to the grand jury and say, I have some evidence for your review, and they can investigate it.
Yes.
Anybody can supposedly go before a grand jury and present anything they want to.
Correct.
And the grand jury can decide whether to indict or not. Okay. That's the indictment. On the information side, that's a different thing altogether. It has nothing to do with the grand jury.
Right.
A prosecutor somehow got some information. Either somebody told it to him, or he did his own investigation or whatever, and he pressed charges against somebody. But according to Gina, he would have to get a judge to approve that.
Yes.
So I wonder how many people were hanged in Texas history on that one.
A lot. I think they need to bring the hanging laws back. In fact, the hanging laws were never repealed. They're still on the books. It'd be a whole lot cheaper to hang them than to electrocute them.
It's kind of hard to think in terms of our jural covenant because we've experienced so much with the de facto.
Yeah. It's doing a 180 of what we have learned through our lives and what we are learning how our lives are supposed to have been.
Okay, then can we move on to another phrase in this section? Okay, and that's the phrase after the comma. It says, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or offenses against the laws regulating the militia. So in those areas, in the Texas Army, I guess, or the Texas Navy, or the regulated militia, those rules are totally different.
Yes,
they file under military law.
Right.
And they did have a military law that they know rules back then.
And just curious, this regulating the militia, what is that militia? Is that the militia that's called, or is that, like, in the Constitution, I guess, somewhere it says that all men of certain ages are members of the militia, but they're not regulated?
They are called in by the sheriff. If a militia is needed, then the sheriff brings it in. We have an actual militia that's under the Army right now that they train and everything, but they don't go out looking for problems. But they're ready if the Republic Army ever needs them. And they fall under the military rules. Texas has several militias. Most of them are not lawful.
I guess my point was that I'm a member of the militia whether I like it or not.
Right.
But I'm not regulated.
Right.
And therefore, not being regulated, I'm not subject to this clause here.
Right. You're still, believe in the militia is sovereign, but you're sovereign as a individual and not under the group. I don't know how else to word that.
That sounds good. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions on Section 8? All right. just a heads up, it's 20 minutes till 10. Do we want to continue on, or do we want to call it a night and go over the stuff that we have learned?
I think we should call it a night.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Well, Matt, would you close us in prayer?
Yes, Gina, sure will. Thank you. Heavenly Father, we're so thankful for the men and women that went before us that penned this document, and we're so thankful that we are alive now to be able to go through it and try to comprehend it. And we, again, ask you to make these words make sense to us so that we can apply them in our lives. And I ask you to bless everybody's evenings as they go on to do other things, and to protect them and take care of them. And also, Heavenly Father, to protect our elected officials, our governor, and et cetera, et cetera. In Jesus Christ's name I pray, amen.
Amen. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Matt.
Can you press recording off?